Okay, the recording's on.
The time is now 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, February 11th, 2025. This is the start of Summit County Service Areas Number 3's public meeting. The meeting is being held at the Mountain Life Church in Park City, Utah. The first item on the agenda is a welcome from the chair.
Welcome.
Thank you. The next item is roll call. And we ask for the roll call if you'll also, when you state your name, your conflict of interest or none if applicable. If Otto, we can start with you.
John Blum, no conflict.
John Ball, no conflict of interest.
David Olson, no conflict of interest.
John Wittgen, no conflict of interest.
Rick Parisi, no conflict of interest.
Chris Bullock, Rosenwald, no conflict.
Sean O'Brien, general manager, no conflict of interest.
Vincent Palborgian, operations, no conflict.
Nathan Bracken, legal counsel, no conflict.
And Jody?
Jody and Agnes, office manager, no conflict. I just want to confirm, I think everybody's there except Carrie.
Roll call, no conflict.
Carrie,
no conflict.
Okay. Derek is not here.
Derek will be here in about half an hour.
Okay, thank you. If someone just lets me know when he walked in so I could document it in the minutes, that would be great.
Will do. Next item on the agenda is public comments. We do have members of the public present and online, but let's start if any of the members present at the meeting would like to speak. Now would be a time, and we ask that you just limit your comments to 3 minutes, please.
Karen Warren. And I live at 7773 Greenfield. And I just have a question regarding this invoice that I received. The homeowner is Benjamin Cohen. And I received this invoice for $300. And it said annual invoice for January 1st, 2024 through December 31st, 2024. And the service address is the 40 vacant acres adjacent to our house. And I try to read the minutes and everything that go online. And I guess we don't have any service there. So what is this?
What you're looking at is the annual 2024. We sent out the annual invoices, and the vacant lot fee is a $300 annual fee.
It's a vacant lot standby fee,
regardless of the size.
Correct. If it's a buildable lot, they're eligible to paying a vacant lot in this. Its service can be connected to the water system at a later date.
Have you not gotten one of these before then?
No.
I wonder why that is.
There was an audit done earlier this year or last year to clean up our billing codes, and Karen's property or her son-in-law's property was not originally listed as a vacant standby lot, and the vacant standby also covers fire flow in case someone needed a hookup for that. So
fire flow. So yeah. You mean there's potentially a fire hydrant?
There is a fire hydrant adjacent to that property.
It's in front of Jenny Moran's old property.
Thank you.
It's covered with a snowplow. Nobody was there either. So this $300 is just that we had the opportunity to hook up to the district water service. Is there a water line there? Does it go down Greenfield?
Yeah, is there a meter there?
If there's a hydrant there, there must be. The water line goes down
part of that way, and then at the other end, it comes part of the way up down there on the undeveloped Greenfield Road. So theoretically, yes, if you were to build something on it in the future, you could connect to the water line.
Does that water line go all the way down to the developed part of Greenfield?
What do you mean? Is it east by Valley?
Miles, you know, and then you get into the developed area. Is that water line all the way down there?
So it comes up Valley Drive, yep, from Valley Drive up that undeveloped portion of Greenfield Drive.
Okay.
So the point I was going to make, Chris, you said that. So the thing is you would have a right to connect to the water system if and when the lot's developed. And the service area incurs cost maintaining the water line and maintaining the fire flow. And so that's what this fee is intended to do. So if and when you're ready to develop the lot, if you comply with the necessary rules, you check the right boxes, you have a right to connect to the system. So that's why the standby fee is paid. So, Chris, I just want to make it clear that this isn't that she may. It's like if she wants to and everything's in order, she is entitled to connect.
Thank you, Nathan.
So we could feasibly, even if we didn't build a house, we could say, well, we want to have a faucet on the property to feed the elk.
Yeah, well, that would be a land use decision that the county would make. And typically, if you wanted to do something with your property, you'd go to the county.
But all we would have to do is just hook up to a water line that goes down Greenfield. And would we have to pay additional fees to do that?
There is a connection fee to connect to the system. So the standby fee is much less than what you would pay during the year. If you were paying during the year, you'd pay a usage fee. There'd be a base rate, and then you'd have other fees based on how much water you use to offset the cost. So
just like the house.
Yeah. This fee is just intended to pay for the service area's cost of maintaining that line and maintaining fire protection to your property. So if and when you connect, it's there, it's ready, it has the capacity, and you can connect.
And have you ever checked that water line?
I'm the attorney. I'm not an engineer.
Okay.
Chris is the water master.
If there was a fire there and they needed to access the water line, has it ever been?
So,
is there water running through that water
line?
Yes,
there's water running through the line.
All the way down to the
manhole. We check those fire hydrants in a rant. It happens every couple of years. We'll go through every fire hydrant that's within the subdivision, testing those and making sure that they're operational and so forth. So I would have to look it up and try to find the information on that fire hydrant to see what that is. But I know the one just off of at Valley was used this summer, and then the one off of Shepherd's Lane, which also comes, the water line comes out right there. Shepherd Lane doesn't connect to that Greenfield Road, but the fire hydrant's right there. There's like a little dirt road.
Mm-hmm.
So I can speak for those two. I can't speak for the one
so
that's
the
right there.
So the houses that are actually on Bittner, that whole little group that's over there by Bittner, do they have fire hydrants off of Bittner?
They're connected to Mountain Regional Water off of Bittner Road. I assume that there's fire hydrants right there. I don't know. I can't speak for Mountain Regional.
So that's why there aren't any more fire hydrants going further down Greenfield, because those four properties are on a different water system.
Correct.
The bigger properties. She's
yes. Talking. Yeah. Yeah. The long, skinny ones that connect the Bender Road. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, can I have this back?
Thank you very much.
That's the only reason that I came, was to find this out. And so it is kind of interesting that we're, when did you say the audit was done? Why are we paying for last year?
Well, the annual bills get billed at the end of the year for that previous year.
Yeah, it is full down there. All right, well, thank you.
Sure.
I'm sure they'll be really happy.
We're on public comments now. Any members that are present here would like to speak?
I'm Luann Lukumbat, 625 Summit. First of all, I want to say thank you for all your help with the handicap parking and accessibility of the sidewalk. I appreciate it getting cleared up right away. That was really, really nice. I also just want to preface my next comment with, I know I'm on the extreme side with the roads. My husband is very sick, and we are frequent visitors to the emergency room. If he falls, we have to go to the emergency room just to have him checked, which we had to do again the other night because he just bumped into the wall. Like, oh, goodness. But luckily, it was a night, and they had plowed all the roads, and I was so grateful. So I didn't have to call the fire department. I could just drive in myself, and everything was fine. But I am very, so I'm like very emotional about this whole thing. And that's why last week when we had all this slush on the roads, I was so frustrated. And I felt frustrated that usually when I call Chris, he takes care of everything. And I don't doubt that you're working on it. But when I called at 9 o'clock, because the roads were so bad, I could only go 4 miles an hour on my part of the road. And I came home, and he said they were working on it. And I came home at 3 o'clock, and nothing was done. And I called again, and he said he checked. And at 5 o'clock, I sent a text, so there was a car stuck on the road. And at 7 o'clock, there was a second car stuck on the road. And my neighbor was in my house because she couldn't get up the road. And I couldn't get any information to know what was going on. And I was extremely frustrated and just praying that we would have to go to the hospital that night. But I just didn't know if we'd be able to make it okay. And so just having the response back, like, I appreciate that you pick up my call all the time, Chris, because I know I'm a frequent caller. And on Sunday, you got them down there. They sanded Silver Creek Road, and it was a sheet of ice, and I appreciate that. But when it was so slushy, and I just felt so frustrated that I couldn't figure out what was going on. I didn't know. And not knowing is really hard. It got cleared off again the next day. Fantastic. Like, wow, super duper. But that day, there was just, like, nothing happening, and I didn't have any information, which makes me even more excited about the situation.
Good. Thank you, Luann, for that comment. But we can do what we can. I don't know about your text message or whatever and the response there. Just knowing that if you go through the HubSpot number, that text message does never come to me. So
it's the same number that I called you on, I'm not sure. But when I called, I never saw anything happen, and I didn't hear anything back. So what's the best way for me to handle situations like that?
I think if you call into the service area number, I'll say 95% of the time you're going to get me anyway, like you said. And that's the 435-500-6613. A lot of times you're calling me directly on my number.
Yes, and I'm happy to call you on a different number. That's a better number. Let me put this down in my phone right now so I will follow the best protocol. Okay, so the number I should call you on is?
The 435-500-6613.
So I should call you on that number when I have history.
Yeah.
Okay. And
if you need to text the other number that you have that I won't say out loud.
Because we'll come out in incremental hours after snowfall or...
Yeah, so they come out and they check. They have some cameras and upper... where they're watching the upper roads. On this particular day, you know, I had them out working, clearing the mashed potatoes, as we call them, off the road. I'm assuming they cleared roads, the snowbank melted even more with the rain and stuff that we had, and just made more mashed potatoes. I can't speak for people running off the road and stuff like that, but that's kind of how the response is. And then if they're not responsive themselves, I call them. But they have people monitoring on their own. So
is there an emergency line, Chris, for Lisa Jersey, 5-8-9-0-B-O, in a situation like that? where, you know, it's an emergency that you need to get in touch with anybody off hours or something when the roads are
that bad. That 5-435-500-6613
is an emergency.
Is an emergency number.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Anyone else want to make public comments?
We do have someone online.
Yes, I have one that was emailed in that I need to read in, but we're going to let John Noel Slosky go first.
Good evening, guys. John Noel Slosky, 1494 Oak Ridge Road. Just a very quick comment. It kind of got under my skin a few months ago when that older gentleman kind of told you all that being on the board is a thankless job and kind of insulted everyone's intelligence. So I just want to go out of my way tonight to say thank you for not only what you're doing, but the way that you're doing it. I appreciate you, and I know a lot of people do, too. And that is all.
Thank you, John.
Thanks, John. Renee, do you have a comment? Are you just listening?
Nope, I'm just here in attendance. I don't have a comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. So I did get an email today that I am going to read in. And it is from Glenn Colvin. He lives at 472 Maple Drive. He said, I'm unable to make tonight's meeting, but would like to enter the following into the public comments. First, I would like to commend the board for changes to the officers in the January meeting. It was a constructive step to move forward as the chair needs to look at the requirements of the entire community when setting agendas. Second, I request the board publicize the costs associated with responding to the accusations last year that began at the June 2024 board meeting that the state auditor's office found not to be credible. The cost should include both the direct costs, such as legal expenses, and an estimation of the staff time devoted to responding. Combined with the $100,000 to force compliance with state-mandated well meters, the 200 residences on the water system deserve to know what they had to spend for a small minority of well users to comply with state statutes. It is unfortunate that a vocal minority can waste the money that would have been much better spent on water system infrastructure. In closing, I would like to thank all the board members for volunteering their time to serve on the board, even those with whom I disagree. I extend my appreciation to the service area staff, including the contracted subject matter, legal, and engineering experts. All residents should understand how lucky we are to have a professional staff who strive every day to meet the needs of every resident. And that's all the comment we have.
Anyone else have a comment here?
I just want to say, I'm Laurie Maggard.
Hi. And your address, please?
Yes, 1023 Wileway. I love Mammoth. I can get from my house at the very top of Wileway into the gym or into the pharmacy, into the grocery in like 6 or 7 minutes. It's been amazing. So that's great. That's really great. And I know it probably was a big project. I don't come to these very often. So I have sat on HOA boards and it kind of came off like that. So I do appreciate your service and the time and the energy everyone spends. So that's good. I'm happy Agnes is open. I'm curious if we have any information about the newer development that might happen out there. I don't know if we're going to speak about that tonight.
It's not on the agenda.
Okay. So it's probably not happening anytime. Right away.
I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Anyone else have a comment?
Moving on to Section 3, Administrative and Financial. The first item of business for this would be approval of the January 14, 2025 minutes. At this time, I'll open it up for discussion among the board members or approval.
Anybody have any questions about it? No. I motion to approve the minutes.
I'll second.
Scott made the motion. Rick seconded.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, the vote was unanimous. Next item is approval of expenditures. We have three invoices for which we're seeking approval tonight. Again, at this time, I'll open up for a discussion or approval.
So there, if memory serves, that two of them are Wolf invoices.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Chris, can you speak to those invoices if you have them in front of you? Just so.
So one of those is a preseason startup, which is the 18-5 for them mobilizing all the equipment and getting set up for the snow removal for the season. And then the other one is just the monthly service of snow removal activities.
So what is mobilization, like setting up? What are they set up?
That's bringing in all their equipment and setting up for the winter. So they're bringing their trucks and everything. They're getting the chains put on, stuff like that. The curb markers or markers around the road. We don't have curbs, but marking different things in that, just in preparatory for the snow season.
And the way that contract is written, I don't know if I can mention an amount, but there is a specific amount that they mention. Do we have to hit that? Do we owe them? Do we owe use them for plowing? So if for whatever reason it never snows again this year, whatever we pay so far is what we pay. We're not making up the delta between the stated value of the contract.
That is correct.
Okay.
And do we pay that startup fee every year?
Yes.
Always with Wolf? We've always had that?
No. It was negotiated in a few years back.
Before I got here.
Yeah,
before.
We're going back probably 7-8 years at least.
Yeah. And is that typical of other contracts like this that you've seen? Like when you did the RFP, I didn't see that in there. Was that like, is that something like most snowmobile companies?
Most companies ask for it, and it's a negotiable thing.
And is that higher or average or low? Were you shocked when you saw that amount, or was that?
No.
You weren't?
Like no, because I can look at other projects, probably like the county project here for Mammoth. Uh-huh. That mobilization was probably
in the we'll be discussing snow removal
RFP later on in the meeting.
What's surprising is the billing for December is actually like half of that. Like, probably because it wasn't a lot of snow, right? But,
The mobilization will be billed against 2024's budget. So even though we got the invoice in January.
It's just for context, just to do a little bit of excavating at my house this summer, I had a company say they were going to charge me $2,000 just to bring an excavator up here.
Yeah,
so, they're not renting. That's just to transport it from the door up here. Yeah, so I guess that helps.
And then the new booster pump, where is that for?
So we have a booster pump along Silver Creek Road, just below the guardrail. It pumps water from the lower system, from the Silver Bullet, basically, up to the high field tank, which comes down into the upper culinary system. We have two booster pumps so that we're always have a backup there. One of those failed and we had it replaced.
So when or if the Silver Bullet goes, will that pump still be usable the same way it's being used now?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Yeah, we've got to get the water to the higher elevation on Highfield tank, so it will always be in this.
Any additional questions for Chris? You're good? All right. Motion to approve.
One second.
All
in favor? I made the motion. Rick seconded.
Aye.
Aye.
Okay. The vote was unanimous. Item 3C is review of personnel policy. This is an annual review of our personnel policy. Trustees want to make comments or suggestions?
Can I just provide some background on this? So this policy, and I think the only person who was me, Vince, and Chris that were around at the time, this policy was first adopted when the board decided to hire its first general manager, Marla Howard. In order to have staff, you have to have a personnel policy. So at the time, the board nor the service area really had a good idea of what they would need in terms of personnel. And so I just took a Utah Association Special District template and basically just used it verbatim. But I suggested at the time, and the board's done this since then, is I don't know if this is going to work for you because it's a template. We don't know what types of staff we're going to have, and so that's why I suggested look at it every year and let's make changes as we need to. And so that's what the board has done. And actually, I think there were some changes in 2024 that were made.
2023.
Well,
yeah, 2019, 2020, and 2023.
And then there was one that we did in. Then there was
updating the holidays.
How long has it been in existence?
When was this first adopted?
2017.
Yeah, 2017. So there's a lot of it was just stuff that was in a template that the Utah Association Special District did. I think they do a good job on these things, but just because we had it in the template doesn't mean we have to keep doing it that way. And that's part of why I suggested let's look at it every year. You know, the holidays were one thing. That's just what they had. And so we've made some amendments over time. You know, we have an acceptable use policy that was mandated by state law that's towards the end of it. And then there are some tweaks that we've made as we've learned different things. But I just want you to be clear that this wasn't something that was crafted from the ground up to be bespoke to the service area, because when we adopted it, we just needed a policy and the service area didn't know what its personnel's needs would be.
What's an acceptable use policy?
So an acceptable use policy, there was some legislation that the legislature passed, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago, that basically said if someone on staff is using their, like for instance, if they use a computer to order lunch or something, that authorized them to do it, otherwise it would be a crime. And so the recommendation that all, like the League and the Utah Association of Special Districts did is come up with some acceptable use policy that puts parameters on the use of public assets or property for personal use. Otherwise, it's kind of a mandated crime. And so the intent of that section of the policy was to comply with that section of the statute. And I think, again, you know, I try to save you on costs, so I just used, I think, what the UASD had put together and copied it in there.
So it's kind of like a safe harbor for the staff.
Yeah.
Or little things, you know. Like.
Yeah, because, I mean, we don't want people using service area property for personal business, but you know, it's like I said, if you use your service area issued computer to order lunch, or you use it to check a personal email on your lunch break, or, you know, things like that, that's the intent of that section. Yeah. So you have a lot of flexibility here. I mean, there are some employment things we need to keep in mind, but I just want to be clear that you aren't bound by what this is. A lot of this was just a template, and if you want to make changes, we can.
So one of the things we're going to talk about tonight was creating a committee to look at the personnel that we have, set expectations, do job descriptions, talk about how we were going to structure the reporting relationship from the board to John, John down, vice versa. This is a great template, but until we set that committee up and really kind of develop what the specific roles are, what the expectations are, what's the definition of performing, overperforming, underperforming. Some of this, I just feel like we might spin our wheels tonight talking about this. The other issue, too, is that, you know, Chris, Jody, and Vince all have components of their job where they're basically giving people really bad news in terms of when they owe money to the service area, or they have a grandfathered conduit that they have to fix, or there's something wrong with, you know, a fee they haven't paid, or they're over on water. There's an element of that job that needs to be protected, which is dealing with someone who's extremely pissed off because they just got a bill. And I don't know how to say it more eloquently than that, but there's nothing in here that describes the job that they're doing. There are no protections in place. So,
what kind of protections? Like, people are with direct, what kind of protections do they get?
Well, for example, the expectation that they're supposed to be customer service oriented first and foremost, and if they're dealing with someone who's super aggressive, you know, there have to be two sides of the story. There's no mediation component to this, just based on what I read. If anyone's read it differently, by all means, we can talk to them.
I mean, I think at a high level, the policy could be a good backdrop and a good template, but from like an HR perspective, there's a lot of stuff in there, but not a lot of it. There's probably some of it that's been practiced and some of it that hasn't. And so if we're going to have a policy, then it's something we have to like abide by and follow, like, because like we haven't done the performance reviews, but they're in there, right? Like, so So I think it's like, again, like a great backdrop for us to follow. But there are just things in there, like changes that have been made to it. I think even when Nathan started, like I've been in HR for 25 years and I haven't really seen a policy that doesn't like have a cap on it on paying PTO out. Like to me, a lot of companies have policies where you can kind of carry over 40 hours up until March 1st and then it's like use it or lose it kind of thing, which encourages a good healthy environment because then people take their vacation too. But then from an accounting perspective, when people leave, all of a sudden your budget isn't hit because someone has 3 or 4 months of PTO, right? So there's just some things in there. Like I do think it's a great template and it looks like it has a lot of good bones, but I do think it would be great if there's stuff that we're not using in there, like isn't being followed, that it doesn't make sense to have it in there if we're not really.
So would that be part of the meetings work then?
I think it's almost like
just the policy and then the reviews.
I think they're kind of different word tracks because if you're looking at the policy, it says that you should be doing this annual reviews. But I think it's like a couple of us, I mean, I'm happy to circulate something to the board and to the staff to say, okay, are we going to do these things or should we look at these things? Like, and everyone can chime in, mm-hmm. You know? Like, I don't think it's a big project. I think it's just looking at, I mean, I look at it quickly and see just a couple of things that I'm like, do we necessarily need this? We're not going to do it or if we're not going to need it. That's just my opinion.
And I just want to build on what Perry's saying. That was always, that's why I had the concern when I said this. I'm like, here's a template. These things work generally most other places, but I don't know if that's what you need or will do here. So I do think it would be helpful for you to go through and maybe do a triage or an inventory of these are the things that we're doing. These are the things that we're not. If we're not doing it, do we have to? Now, some of that stuff, you know, we need to see. We have to comply with some employment laws. But we did have, there was some discussion, if I recall, and Chris, since it's gone, on the PTO. And I think, if I recall, we discussed this in the beginning, and that was one of the biggest questions I had, is how do you want to handle PTO and sick leave for these employees? And at the time, it was just one. It was the general manager, and then they hired a clerk. And I think the decision they made at the time was, well, let's not maybe have a cap on it because that could maybe some people will want more time off. And I think that was what Marla wanted, as opposed to more money, and it gave them some more flexibility. But that was for the personnel they had then. And that's part of the reason why I think it makes sense to review this, because you don't have the same personnel that you had back in 2017 when this was adopted.
Yeah. And I think also sometimes having more of this information can sometimes hurt you to have it in there, right? Because then if you don't do it, then it could be, someone could be disgruntled as an employee or staff member down the line. And so, you know, like the merit increases or cost of living, like I think that ends up being something that the board works with the staff on anyway. But when you're looking at like wording, like they're not automatic, but if there's funds available, and then let's say you don't give them, someone could say, well, there were funds. Like, I just think you get into a little bit of a gray area. And so some of that, I mean, obviously there's also a lot, like, there's a big section on substance abuse or a big section on dress code, and some of those get into gray areas now today with the different regulations. So I think sometimes less is more with these types of policies. So
yeah.
If we could just like clean it up a little bit and bring it up to date, I think it'd be better for everyone.
Would you be interested in being on the committee to do this? I know Derek has talked about it, and he's not here, but when he gets here, it's something maybe, can we push the idea of creating a committee to go over this and then come back to the board and say, here are some recommendations based upon.
I mean, if we had it even in Word, I could just redline it to show you guys. Like, I don't think it would take me more than like an hour or two to just say, like, there's a more skeleton version of the same thing and not really changing much, but more just cleaning it up.
But part of the committee would also be responsible for making sure the job descriptions match up.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's a little subset, right?
Yeah, but if we can just group it all together.
Yeah, I'm happy to help.
All right, so okay. can we set that committee when Derek gets here so he has an opportunity to participate if he chooses?
You can, and I can provide some other examples of personnel policies so you have something else to look like. Because like I said, this was just a template. There may be other templates out there, or we could do something from whole cloth. It's your call.
That'd be great.
And Nathan, you had talked today about consolidation.
This is something I've mentioned. I know I've mentioned this to Scott and to David, and I think some other have spoken with me offline. But one of the recommendations I've been making since this policy is to do a service area code. And the challenge, when I was hired in late 2016, the prior practice of the service area has just been to adopt these kind of one-off regulations or resolutions that have adopted a policy. And they all kind of exist in their own separate realm. And I would prefer, and most of my other clients are like this, is put it all into one document with titles and chapters and everything. So that's been a longstanding recommendation that I've had and I've made to various boards. It's a time-consuming thing, and there just hasn't been money to do it because we've usually been putting out whatever fire of the day we're dealing with. So I just want to reiterate that recommendation. If we're going to look at this personnel policy, and we're going to talk about water rates, you know, the water policy also wasn't something. That was something that was there, and we've amended it and revised it as we've gone along, just because that was usually the quickest, the easiest thing to do to deal with whatever issue was pressing at the time. But I do think now that you've got a new board, that it would take some time to kind of look at all these policies and maybe come up with some new stuff and make it all cohesive into one title. So that way we're not updating a resolution. We adopt an adopting resolution and we're amending Title I, Chapter 2, you know, and it's just an easier, more cohesive document. So that's just a recommendation I made with staff during our coordination call this week, and just wanted to share it with the board.
Are these rules for living in the community? You said codes. Are they like HOA codes or what are they?
Well, the service area isn't an HOA. It's a special district. So typically what most of my other special districts have is what's called administrative rules and regulations.
Sure.
So it's, for instance, we have our water regulation. We have our roads regulation. They're separate documents. They're not, they're all part of your collective rules and regulations, but they exist separately. They have slightly different formatting. My concern with that is you get some inconsistencies. You know, you also have your rules of order and regulation, mm-hmm. and then you have some other things that you do. So there's a difference, in my opinion, between the regulations, which are, hey, if I want to connect to the water system, how does that work? Or, you know, if I'm plowing snow into the road and creating a hazard, how is that regulated? Versus internal policies, like some of the resolutions you're going to look at later today, like who's on the check signers and those things. I don't think that type of thing needs to be in your service area code.
That's more administrative.
That's administrative. It's more just so then the public is like, okay, I have a question about what rules apply to me. They can go to the website. There's a link that says administrative rules and regulations. They click on it, and it's everything, rather than have to piece through a bunch of different links. And one of the questions I had is when I took over, we had this massive Google Drive with all these different ordinances, some of them dating back 30, 40 years. And I'm like, is this still valid? Has it been superseded? You know, and it's hard to do that, to read 200, 300 separate documents and figure out what applies and what superseded that. And so that's another reason my hope would be, let's do one cohesive document that applies to everything and just say, this is it. And then from going forward, we can just update that as we go along as a normal city would do. Now, you're not a city, but most districts, if you go to most districts' websites, particularly larger ones, they will have this all in one document, ideally.
Who's going to draft
it? Well, that's the question.
Is that a staff thing more than a board thing?
No, it's usually a staff thing. It's not something the board, you guys are tone at the top. You would provide direction. And so typically, I mean, my initial thought is we could just have the staff go through and say, look, these are the regulations that we're using on a daily basis. And then just take the language we have and then have somebody just put it into a cohesive whole so all the formatting's the same. And then we could take it to you, and then you could go through it and say, okay, this we need to update, this I don't like, or this works, we keep it.
I like it.
John, does the staff have bandwidth to do that?
I think it's something we need to do, which I guess isn't quite answering your question. You know, but so.
But it's not like it means done tomorrow because.
No, yeah, it'd be ongoing, but.
No, this is not an urgent thing. But it's something that's been on the hopper for a long time. It's been something I've been recommending. And the challenge you've always had is we had Marla. And Marla was just trying to get us out of the auditor's office. And she did that. but it was mainly just quick fixes. And so a lot of the policies that we did adopt were, we just need to check a box so we're legally compliant. And now we're at a point where I think we can go back and, just like Kari was saying, this works or this doesn't. And so my thought is, if you're going to do the personnel policy, now might be also a good time. We can start with that.
Sure.
And then we could do it with other things. And I want to be clear, this is something we discussed. This, I think, is a discussion-only item. Usually with these things, there's a fair amount of involvement for me. Like the proposal I said, I think, is something the staff could do. But when it comes to like updating and making sure things are in compliance with the law, that's something you probably need me to weigh in on certain things. But my hope is that the initial step, at least, is something that could be a staff-driven process of at least identifying these are the regulations we use all the time. And they could even say, these are some of the problems that we have. I mean, I have a list of things that I'd like to update, clarify. I'm sure you may do too. And then maybe we could have that discussion there and then see, all right, here's how, what this is going to look like. And I did, years ago, I had one of my law clerks take a stab at this. And we did come up with an initial draft. It's probably 4 years ago. But then, and we had changeover on the board and it kind of got sidetracked for other things. So I have something that we did a long time ago that we might, I may be able to send you for a, as a starting point.
Yeah. That would be helpful for the staff. Yeah.
Yeah.
So should we motion to authorize you to tell the staff to start on this?
I don't, is this an action item? I think it's discussion
no,
only.
I will make a comment that I did knowing we were looking at this and reviewing it. I did look at the personnel policies for Summit County as well as Greater Salt Lake municipalities. And I've requested Wasatch counties. I couldn't find theirs online, but I just started kind of a chart to see where we are in comparison, like just PTO holidays, stuff like that. But Nathan is correct. All the other layouts are very much like in a document, a cohesive document with titles and chapters and all that stuff.
And I should mention, Jody, you mentioned the Greater Salt Lake, I think you meant Municipal Services District, right?
Yes, yeah.
Carla Howard is their general manager, and they're also a client of mine. I don't do the personnel stuff, I do their land use, but they, that, so you're probably going to see a lot of Marla's influence in those documents.
Okay. Any other questions for Nathan? Okay.
Thank you. Item 3D. Is approval of resolution 25-01. This is for us to update our check signers. We'd like to continue having the chair, vice chair, treasurer, and operations manager be check signers, and then the treasurer, chair, and general manager be authorized for PTIF. Public trust. Something fun, investment
check,
fund,
right?
It's a state fund. We have a lot of our funds in that.
We have to write a check to somebody.
Yeah, well, we don't, it doesn't, the checks all come from our U.S. bank. So we have these four check signers. So like I process the check, so I'm not allowed to be a check signer. So.
Can I answer that? It says for public treasurer's investment fund. And so this is a fund that the state created for local government entities to use as a short-term cash investment vehicle. And so you can put your money in the PTIF, and it's basically invested in grade corporate notes and some other things. So it's a way for local government entities to get a little bit of return on their money, so to speak. So it's kind of like a savings account that's managed by the state treasurer.
So you're getting a little bit of dough while you're waiting.
Yeah, but we're not a, obviously, you know, there are problems, of course, with the government entity investing in the stock market or doing those types of typically private activities, which is why the state created this PTIF. So pretty much every local government entity has a fund with them, and it's really intended just to be kind of short-term use.
Got it. Thanks.
So for this resolution, there's no change. The only thing with changing the names of positions since we had elections in January. So at this point, I think I'll open it up for a discussion for the board on resolution 25-01 or for approval.
Motion to approve. Second. All in favor?
Scott motion. Aye. Scott made the motion.
Aye.
David seconded.
Aye.
The vote was unanimous. The item 3E on the agenda is approval of resolution 25-02. And that's just declaring the three vacancies we have that will We have three terms that expire at the end of 2025, which means we'll have elections in November for those three positions. And this is just a declaration of candidacy for the, those three terms, which would be two lower and one upper.
Are you saying that we need to declare now?
Yes.
Well, Derek's not here.
Why do you have to declare person. Now? What if they change their mind between now? Person,
right? But not so much the person. The
wait, you mean the individual? I don't think you mean the individuals have to declare.
No.
Positions are declared.
That's right. So this is required by state law. We don't technically have to do this resolution, but we've talked about at the staff level. We thought it would be a good idea just so everybody's on board with the date. So before February 1st, we had to notify the Summit County Recorder's Office, the Summit County Clerk's Office that we had vacancies. And so the Clerk's Office was like, okay, you know, you need to confirm when you're going to do the declaration of candidacy. It's all set out in law. And so the point of this resolution is to just say, here's when we're going to accept declarations of candidacy.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're on. Well, actually, declarations of candidacies are filed in June. The election's in November.
Right. So this references a termination on December 31st, 2027 for three of the trustees. Should that say 25?
Correct.
Okay. Jody, did you prepare this one? I don't think.
Yes, I did.
So these resolutions, I have a notice guide that I prepared for the staff with template resolutions that they can just fill in the blanks. So I think that's what you used here, right, Jody?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we have three positions that are expiring at the end of 2025, December 31st, 2025.
Yeah, but this one says 2027.
Yeah, I can see that now. I wrote the wrong date on there. Sorry.
Wrong date. The individuals listed, those terms are the three that are expiring on December 31st, 2025. So I'll have to update. I didn't see that when I was putting the packet together.
So we can't vote on this then because it's inaccurate?
No, you can vote to amend with that change. You say, I move to approve subject to changing that date.
Okay. Are there any additional questions on this?
I guess when we establish the zones, like in terms of like how the zonage was in terms of how many spots are upper and how many spots are lower, was the neighborhood census the same as it is now? And is there any reason to believe, because it seems like we've always had like a harder time from what you guys have said with lower, that there would be any reason to ever consider like 3-3 and like one of the positions? I know we talked about this and we sent some information, but maybe like one of the positions maybe being upper or lower.
Yeah, so
good reason to think about that.
In my experience, it's just kind of sometimes we've had harder times with upper, sometimes we have a harder time with lower. Right, most recently it was lower, so there is a process. So the way it's set up now was established by Summit County when they created the service area. So there is a process by which the board could go through and change its makeup, and we had talked about that last year, and that's why I was raising it then, because we wanted to change it. The time to do that was then, before we're now kind of in this year's election cycle, because you know, there is a way to go and do that. So Carrie, to your point, we could change it. It's up to you. My thought in the past was if we wanted to go from 7 to 5, because during my entire tenure here, we haven't been able to keep a 7-member board for more than a couple months. Somebody moves or somebody has to step down, and then we're back to 5. So my thought at the time was if we could have 2 upper, 2 lower, and then 1 at large that represents the whole group. But I think I'd have to go back and look, because we had to tell the clerk on February 1st which seats we have open. I don't know if we can change that now. But we could, well, maybe there is time. I need to look in that to see if we could reallocate it. But there's a process. If there's a public hearing, you need to get some public input on what it looks like. If you're going
to
have.
If there's any thought, like, so that you, future state, even when we're all gone or whatever it is, if it makes it easier, whether they decide down the road to do like a 5, but would it be easier to have like 3-3 and then have 1 that can go either way to help with filling that spot?
And that was potentially the proposal. I that we were talking about earlier last year. You could do that if you want. There's a hearing process. There's a notice process. I don't know if we can do that now with the election. I need to double check that.
If I can just jump in really quick, looking at the parcels. So we have 586 parcels in Silver Creek Estates, and 200 of them are upper, which is A, B, and C plats, and then 321 are lower, which is why there's been more people on the lower. It's because the breakdown is representative of that, just historically.
And wasn't there something, though, that the plots, so on the lower, a lot of them weren't occupied, whereas all of the uppers were occupied, I believe was stated at some point?
No, there's 33 vacant lots, and if I can remember off the top of my head, it's like 20 of them are vacant in the lower and 10 of them are vacant in the upper. So it's actually kind of the same percentage as the number of parcels, coincidentally.
So, I mean, I'd ask if there's desire on the board to have that one floating position, we can check with the county if we haven't locked our, you know, we're still pretty early on. We have notified them of these vacancies, but if you want me to go to explore whether or not we're locked in or want to proceed with the possibility of having a floating position.
How much is involved to do that? I mean,
it would be a public hearing.
Yeah, so I pulled up the statute. It would require a two-thirds vote, the board.
Okay.
But you'd have to do a public hearing. Now, this is something that you have to review your division boundaries at least every 10 years. I think we have done that because this isn't the first time this issue's come up.
Do we think that we know? When did we last look at our boundaries?
I think it was – I've always been the one that has recommended that we look at this, and I've always been, no, we like it the way it is. So I think it was probably last 2 years or so. I mean, I haven't represented the service area 10 years, and we've talked about it at least two or three times. This is now probably the fourth. So it's been looked at every time we have a vacancy and it's hard to fill. The discussion is, do we downsize from 7 to 5? The issue you have now is you have a full 7 board. So you can't downsize now. You've got a full board. Now you would just be talking about reallocating the boundaries of your division. So you'd have to prepare a proposal that describes what you want to do with the proposed boundaries. You'd have to hold a public hearing, and then we'd have to go through that process. What I don't know, and I have to look at the election code, is are we too far into this year to do this? Now, what you can't do is I think there's a time limit that you can't change it more than once every 4 years, but we haven't changed it at all, so I think that would apply.
I would think it would be helpful to find out when is the trigger point, when it's the best time to do it, at the beginning of whatever cycle, because now we're in a cycle, it sounds like.
Yeah.
And messing with it now would seem maybe messy.
Well, and I might be wrong on that. I need to double check that. Because the election's still a ways off, and my concern is just the declaration of candidacies need to be filed in June. And so we need to have all this done by June.
That's tight.
Yeah. That's, I think, notwithstanding any sort of prohibitions in the election code, I'm just concerned about doing this in a right way, that you get it all done in time. So that, because that's what, to me, I wanted to do this last year, if you were going to make changes, because then we could have it all done. We could have said, hey, we've made these changes, could have told the county clerk, and then we would have basically a year in advance to make these changes, because we could have made the changes effective this election. And we may still be able to do that. It's just we have to have it done by June so people know what they're declaring for.
Yeah, I'd recommend for the board that's just too tight. It's a reasonable thing to do.
It's worth looking into.
Yeah, for sure. But maybe it's not high on the priority compared to some of the other things.
What changes are we talking about? What are we looking at? Changing the board constitution to 3 up, 3 down, 1 floater.
Oh, okay.
I mean, is there any interest in doing that? Because I don't have any interest in changing it. Unless we have interest. Unless the majority of people are interested in doing that.
Right.
We should just vote on this and go with it. I mean, if it's not, because I don't want to change it.
Yeah, I think it's proportionate to the makeup of Silver Creek, right?
I mean, if there's enough people that want to change it, then we could vote on that. But if it's not going to happen, we should just.
And we don't need a vote on this.
I'm sorry, what?
No, we can just vote on.
You can motion
to
approve these elections right here.
It's not on the agenda.
No, just to approve what we're supposed to approve right now.
Oh, I see.
Right. Not to pass that along into the future or try to change anything for November.
Yes.
Because I don't want to change anything for November. So.
Well, that's not what we're voting on. We're just
But if there's not a majority that want to make the changes to the board for this November.
That's not on the agenda.
No, we can approve this. This is what we're voting on right now.
You can approve or disapprove.
Or we would vote just to amend this.
This resolution.
I don't want to amend that.
I think that this is...
Separate issues.
There are separate issues. So what this is saying is, look, these are the vacancies we have, and this is when we're going to do declarations of candidacy. It's all set out in law. We don't really have a lot of discretion. But the point was is, we want to have a discussion with the board so you're all on the same page since this is new. We have a totally appointed board right now, and that was the reason why we just want to make sure everyone's on the same page. I think the point that Carrie's trying to make, and correct me if I'm wrong, is, hey, I don't know if we want to keep this current makeup. And so if we want to make a change, what you do is table this and then have another discussion if you want to make the makeup.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah. So.
And I mean, my only thought is, like, when we look at the delineation and how the boundaries are they boundaries based on if everyone, I mean, I don't think everyone in the upper is on a well, and I don't think if everyone in the lower isn't unconnected, is that correct? Or is it, it's divided by like Westwood, or is it, it's a boundary type of?
You're correct.
It's plat number. So A, B, and C are considered upper. There are 20 people who are in, have one of those upper plats that is unconnected water just because the water line goes up to Crescent. But for the most part, it's by plat number, not by your well or water.
Yep. And I just want to interrupt for the minutes to say that Derek Price arrived at 6:25 p.m.
And I'm not saying we have to do anything. I just think it's something, if we get into a predicament, like what is the process? Like, let's say some of the board members who are here right now, they leave, we don't have as much success filling them, and instead of it going into the county, is there an opportunity to make one of those a swing position? That's all I was asking.
Yes, that is an easier thing to do, because here you have a full board and we'd be reallocating your current districts. But if that's what we've, that's, that has typically been the discussion the board has had in the past, is we had 7, 2 resigned, we couldn't get anybody to fill the spot. And so the discussion was always, okay, we can just go down to 5 because we're not taking away anybody's seat. We have these 2 vacancies, we can do away with those, and then maybe we could redo the boundaries. So if we had, for instance, 2 in upper that were gone or 2 in lower, we could redo that. So that's an easier thing because that doesn't affect an election.
That was just my question, just being educated on. Like right now, it's kind of moot. We have everyone.
And hopefully you will. And that's, and for the record, the reason why the board has always decided to keep 7 seats, it's a lot of work and many hands make light work. And the prior boards were like, we get benefit from everybody being on here. And, you know, the more people we have, the easier it is. But you do have a very large board for a relatively small population size.
So are we going to, Otto, did you want a motion?
Yeah, a motion to approve. Elections in November.
Second. With the change of the
track,
right?
They'll make it to 2025.
Correct. We motion to amend first and then second that and then vote on the amending?
I think you could say I move to approve the resolution as presented, subject to changing the dates in the recitals from 2027 to 2025.
Okay,
so moved.
What are you doing? Motion to approve this.
Okay.
The changes to 2025.
Otto made the motion. John Ball seconded.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Carry that. Okay. That vote was unanimous.
Just confirming this is the first vote with Derek here. So we call 7.
Okay. Correct. Yeah, unanimous with 7. I'm going to skip to item 5 on the agenda, which is our water rate discussion. Do we want to open this up? I know, Nathan, this was the time you wanted to talk about some legislation.
So I've mentioned this before, and I think I've sent the board some email updates. My recommendation on the water rate is that you hold off until the end of the legislative session to see what sort of bills that we have. There are two bills that could potentially have an impact. One of which is, and I don't think it would have an impact this year, but there's a bill that would assess a fee to every water supplier based on how much water you consume. And that fee would then be used to fund the Division of Drinking Water. That bill, what it does is it authorizes the Division of Drinking Water to go through a process to establish the fee. So it's not something that would happen immediately, but it's something you're probably going to need to keep in mind, that you're going to have this pass-through cost. The UASD is trying to get language into that bill that says, hey, look, so this is a mandatory fee that we have to pay and we don't have any discretion over. We don't want to have to go through the time and expense of having to go through a hearing on it. We just want to be able to put it on our bill and say, here's the state's fee that we've got to pay. So that one I expect will pass. It passed the Senate unanimously. It passed out of the House committee last Friday unanimously, and now it's on its way to the House floor.
What kind of fee are we talking about? What do we, $100,000, $5,000?
I don't know.
Is it like the fuel tax fee, so we're going to pump so many gallons?
That's exactly what they're trying to do.
On the gas pump, too, there's a little sticker. The state gets something, the Fed gets something, and it's on every gallon of gas.
That's what they're trying to come up with. Now, technically, the way that this bill is drafted, it's SB 80, it's the sponsor, Senator Sandel, is it all it does at this point is it authorizes the division, or it requires the Division of Drinking Water to establish a fee, but then says, here are the things to consider when you establish it. And they'll have to go through a rulemaking process with public comment. And so they want it to be based on how much water is consumed by the district as a whole, and then a number of other more technical things. Now, Rural Water, they asked me to testify about some concerns that they have with the bill, which I did. And my concerns with it, I think, are the same with Rural Waters. And what I've expressed to staff is consumption varies significantly from one, you know, we have one number one year and a very different number the next year. And so if the point is to provide a stable source of revenue to the Division of Drinking Water to operate the Safe Drinking Water Act, that's not all that stable. The second thing is I think it could lead to some inequities, because you could have some very efficient systems that are in lower elevation, high temperature areas that use a lot more water than a place that's, say, higher up like here, where we just have cooler temperatures and a shorter irrigation season. But in talking to the bill sponsor and others, they don't think they can get it passed without that conservation piece, because that's the focus of the legislature, is incentivizing and forcing as much conservation as possible. So it's not a bill I'm happy about. I would prefer that they look at something, maybe a host of factors, maybe consumption along with, say, how much revenue you have or other things, but they're pretty focused on just focusing on consumption at this point.
And it's specific to the aggregate of the service area versus individual
users? Yes, yeah, it would just be, okay, service area used 350 acre feet, here's, you pay X amount per acre foot.
And then the onus is on the service area to determine how that revenue is generated?
Well, yeah, it would just be, okay, service area, here's your bill, you have to pay it, and then we'd have to allocate that to our customers.
So you're suggesting that we don't touch water rates until we know more about how this is going
to
play out?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that this bill is going to pass. The other bill, I think, has the potential to be more impactful, and that's SB 274. That's a bill by Representative Snyder. He's in House, he's House leadership. He's also the floor sponsor of the other bill. He's a farmer. He's very focused on conservation. This bill, I suspect, has leadership support, and what it would do, remember a while back, I think I reported on a study that the Division of Water Resources did. It was mainly focused on property taxes, authority of water districts, but it also had a number of recommendations on tiered water rates. And one of the recommendations it made about tiered rates is that the tiered rates aren't high enough at the top end to incentivize conservation, because, you know, just the way that they're set up. And part of the reason for that is that the current law says that a rate has to be, if you're a city, reasonable, or if you're a special district, it has to be related to your actual costs. And so because of that, you happen to have low costs, you may just have a top rate that doesn't really have much teeth to it. And so the intent of this bill is it does away with all those requirements, and it says you can set a conservation rate for larger water suppliers over 500 connections, which I don't think the service area has, It would mandate that they set a conservation rate by 2027. You guys, I think it would be optional based on the latest draft that I've seen. But it would say you could set a conservation rate. It doesn't have to be based on cost. It doesn't have to be based on some reasonable standard. It just needs to be what you need to incentivize people to conserve and use less water. The top rate that you charge under the last amendment, which I don't think has been released yet, I'm just working with I know the guy who's writing it, and the UASD and Rural Water have asked me to look at it. The latest version would make it optional for smaller water providers like you. But the top amount that you collect, you'd have to actually use for conservation efforts. So this bill is still very much in the works. I don't know what it's going to look like. This is the one that I think may have the most impact on your rates. It may end up requiring you to do this. It may still remain optional, in which case you don't have to. But long and short of it is there's some things in the hopper that may impact what your rates look like. The reason why I mention that is in order to do a rate hearing, we've got to give 30 days notice. The legislative session ends on March 7th. Your meeting, I think, is like 2 weeks after
March
18th. March 18th. So a little over a week later. So my thought is I would suggest not doing a rate hearing until April so we see what happens in the legislative session. Because I'd hate for you to go through the time and effort to go through a public notice, take public comment on a proposed rate, and then have the legislature impose something. Now, to be clear, I'm not expecting them to have anything. We probably won't have to do anything if we have to until next year or maybe later. But if you're going to go through the process, you might as well knock out the stuff now.
Is the rate is discretionary on behalf of the service district?
Yes. Yes. And so you guys have the authority as the board to set the water rates where you need. Now, historically, your rates have had to have some sort of a nexus to your actual cost. It's always been kind of fuzzy and flexible, and there's a fair amount of case law that gives a lot of deference to what the board sets and what the board determines to be reasonable. But this bill would take away that reasonable actual cost requirement, and instead it would be you can set a rate wherever you need to, basically, as long as it works to incentivize conservation. And the reason for that is House leadership and I think also Senate leadership are one of the things the report found is that often what happens is you have these really high-end users who are using the most water, and they're paying on kind of a per-gallon basis a lot less than the people at the low end. And so the report and what the legislature wants to do is they want to flip it. They want to make the people at the top end either stop using as much or subsidize the people who are using less instead of it being the other way around.
So it makes sense to wait at least.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, it's not that far. You said March 7th. We're talking a month from now.
Yeah. And now's when all the crazy stuff happens.
So if it does get passed, when do you think it would go into effect?
Usually it would go into effect in, say, July 1st. Now, sometimes they may drop in some language that it can go become effective the date the governor signs it. But my expectation is it would go into effect July 1st. If the latest draft that I've seen works, it's likely going to be optional for a small water provider. So it's not something, you don't even have to do the conservation rate if you don't want to. But if it were mandatory, you'd have to do it by 2027. So you'd have some time. But I know you're thinking of your rates. You know, it's just going to be additional authority that you currently don't have. I'll give you my guess, though, and this may be wrong. If it's optional for small water providers now, it will probably be mandatory in 2 to 3 years, because that's what they've been doing with metering, with secondary metering. There's been a huge push to get every connection metered in the state, and originally that was just optional, and each year there's another bill. This bill, including, has a whole other section on secondary water systems. You got to get it metered to be eligible for state funds, that sort of thing.
So if excessive usage fees went into a conservation bucket, if you will, who defines what conservation is? Is it fixing a pipe, putting a hydrant in? Like, how do we budget for that?
I had the same question.
would that fund be used just for our service area, or would it go?
No, it would be used for you. I spoke with the attorneys drafting this, and I asked them about that, because that was one of the big questions that a lot of the other water providers had, is like, well, what do you mean it's mandatory? We want to be able to determine how the funding works. And the response back was, well, we're basically taking off all the sideboards. You can set these rates as high as you want. But if you ever get challenged on that, the court's going to say, well, hey, the whole point of this is to conserve. That's why it's deemed to be reasonable if it's a conservation rate. But you're not using it for conservation, you're just using it for other things. And so the idea was if they required the top rate to be used for conservation purposes, then that would, you know, essentially put you in a stronger legal position, or that the bill would be less subject to challenge, was their thinking.
Is conservation a defined term?
It is a defined term. They have a defined term for conservation effort in the bill. And so the question I had, and one of the things that was also addressed in that report that the Division of Water Resources did back in November, was one of the things they said is enforcement isn't really happening on water use. And so they were trying to figure out a way to incentivize or provide more tools for local water providers to enforce water conservation efforts. And so that was the other reason for this. It's like that we're trying to check this box in this report. And so the idea is that you could also use this. So the conservation effort could be, hey, we're going to enforce, you know, our allocation limits.
Sure.
I asked him that question specifically, and he said, yeah, I think that would qualify. So for you guys, it probably wouldn't mean much.
Isn't the conservation effort the higher price of the water? Like, I don't understand. Like, are you saying we need to spend, if we did that, we need to spend the funds on the conservation effort?
So let's say you had five tiers of water.
Yeah.
And the fifth one is the highest one that's reserved for the people that use the most water.
Right.
The money that you collect from that fifth top tier is what you'd have to, you could only use that for conservation.
Okay.
Everything else would go in.
What does that mean, like, used for conservation?
I would guess it's going to be something like some of the current policies on conservation, smart timers for irrigation, low flow shower heads, educational stuff, different things like that is what you would
are there
be supporting in the community.
I asked this drafter, I mentioned your weird situation with your allocation limits. I said, would enforcing these allocation limits qualify? He's like, yeah.
Do they set a number of tiers, or we can just make?
You can set as many tiers as you want. I mean,
so we can make the conservation one.
You could make that
really
top
high.
Tier so
we
high.
Have 10 tiers.
Yes.
And go up there if we wanted to.
Or you could have like three tiers,
yeah,
and make the top one so high that no one will realistically hit it. I mean,
$100 a
gallon. Yeah, but again, my guess is that for you guys, at least this whatever passes this session is going to be optional. You don't have to do this if you don't want to. My suspicion and my guess is that eventually. It will be, but you could always wait and see and cross that bridge when you get there.
And it's all annual usage, right? Not monthly?
No. That depends on how you want to set up the rate. The bill does not get into that level of specificity. It's basically you have to have a tiered rate, and if you want to, you can set a conservation rate if you're a small water supplier like you are. Mm-hmm. And then that highest rate, the money would have to go into some sort of conservation program.
So as an example of a conservation program, and we had a woman in here a few months ago where she was worried about, you know, going over because she had her trees and stuff like that, like being able to set up a more efficient watering system on people's property, something like that.
Yeah, it's written very broadly. It's intended to give you, this is according to the people I've spoken with who drafted the thing, to give you as much flexibility as possible. So you could do a flip your, I don't think you guys have park strips, but you could
flip the strip.
Do a flip the strip program with that funding and say, hey, you know, we've gotten these high-end fees, we've put them into a fund. If somebody wants to flip their strip, we maybe have a little bit of assistance there. You could do it, you could maybe if there's a system upgrade, maybe you have some leaky infrastructure, you could put it maybe into a capital improvements fund. Just what they don't want it to be used for, one of the things the report found is that if people think that water conservation is happening to allow for more development, no one will conserve and they'll fight it tooth and nail. So part of the reasoning was, let's make this defensible. Secondly, let's give the public, I'm paying out the nose for this, but it's being used for a good purpose. You know, it's not just going to be used for, you know, something else. It is being used for some sort of conservation effort, and then to give the local water suppliers enough flexibility to determine what that is. So that's my update.
Just a question. So it's like a small service district like this, you said they probably won't mandate us to do a certain rate or anything as long as we're conserving or meeting a requirement. If they deem us not meeting that requirement, would the state step in and take over?
Well, the way that the bill is drafted now, you guys wouldn't have to do this at all. It would be purely optional. But for the cutoff is 500 connections. So I don't think you're that far off, but you're not at 500 connections on your water system. You probably never will be because half your population are connected to the
wells. And when you're talking about connected, are you referring
to? Connected to a water system is the cutoff. So they've said everybody.
We're talking about well uses and.
No.
You're only talking.
Yeah. Only the way that the bill, they use a legal term called retail water supplier. Retail water supplier under the code is defined as a water provider, a public water supplier that has 500 connections or more. Now, we could argue about what a connection is, but I see a connection to a water system, not to somebody's private well. And so I see that as more the lower system. So that's what triggers it. But those guys, they'd have until 2027 to get it in place. And I believe if they don't, then they wouldn't be eligible for state funding or those sorts of things.
Any additional questions on the water? Okay. Mr. Chair, did you want to go back to personnel policy with Derek here? If we want to do some voting on how we want to move forward?
Yeah, we hold off on creating the personnel committee to kind of review the employees, what their goals are, expectations, in addition to the personnel policy. As one of the ideas was to create a committee or subcommittee, if you will, with three people on it. So, is there anyone who would like to be on this committee specifically? Derek, okay.
It's just a different committee than doing like you'd ask me if I'd be interested in just helping clean this up.
It's just coming back.
So I'm happy to help.
Okay. So Derek and Barry, there a third who want to be involved?
Don't everybody jump in at once.
Okay. Should we motion to vote on the constitution of the committee, or are we just going to go?
Yeah, I guess we could clarify, like, what's the committee? The personnel committee?
Oh, the personnel committee.
Personnel committee will consist of Derek, Kerry, and David.
Yeah. Okay. All right, we're good. Congratulations.
Okay, let's move on then to.
Do you have a Word version of this and not a PDF version somewhere?
I have one.
If you could send that'd be helpful, because people will, like, if we redline it, it'll be easier if we cross things out or modify.
Oh, yeah. No, I have a Word version. I could send you that, and I could send you some other examples, other personal. And is it auto?
No, Dave.
Nope.
Oh, Dave. Carrie, okay.
Derek. If you send it to me, I'll send it out.
Okay, I'll send it to you.
So, John, we skip operations manager.
Correct.
You have a synopsis? Or
I asked him if he had anything that he wanted me to share on his behalf, but it was a negative.
Okay.
So I'd like to move to Section 6, which is roads and trail. The first section, Chris, was just if you'd give us an update on roads and trail.
Just a quick update. We've been out trying to patch as many potholes as we can due to the weather. The freeze thaw is not being kind on the roads. But like today we did Westwood and Res, we'll be doing some others probably just after this next snowstorm and continue just that ongoing maintenance until we can do real repairs in the summertime. So if you have some concerns or you see something that comes up quickly, just reach out. We'll try to address it as we can. So.
With respect to snowplowing, if this falls under your features, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Can we get Wolf out to monitor more than they have been? Because Luann, she's not in the room, so I apologize for reference.
She's online.
Okay. Her situation sounds critical. And I think Wolf needs to get out there more often to check the quality of her road and any other roads that people are having problems with.
Okay. I'll visit with them tomorrow and discuss that. I just know that, like, the weather's been so unique this last week.
I get it.
We'll address that as we can.
We'll just have major weather coming in Thursday. Grant's going to be unsettled for at least a week. And, I mean, she's made it clear that it's been problematic. There's a health issue there. I'm sure there are other residents as well. They have to step up. That's just my opinion. I'm not speaking for the board.
Well, if emergency vehicles can't
This is appropriate.
Correct.
Okay, correct.
I'll close those of them tomorrow and we'll come up with a plan and I'll let the board know how they want to address it.
Chris, is there a time of day limitation that we'll pass in their contract?
Time of day?
Yeah, like they don't come out in hours of darkness.
24/7. Yes. And we're going to talk about the RFP here in just a moment. But yeah, they have worked around the clock in the past when needed. So,
and then I don't know if you were gonna, anyone else going to jump into this, but we talked about dissolved solids and salt.
Correct.
It's problematic to the water. Does it? Is there a calculus that we need to look at in terms of Silver Creek Road or any other roads that people are having real problems with?
Like, so we say that we don't use the salt. Due to the sensitive nature of some of the stuff here in Silver Creek. But on a case-by-case basis, I have applied it in the past.
Okay.
Wolf is not set up to do that, and I've applied it.
So that would be an extra expense, which we have to approve that in advance as a board, or are you going to do it based upon?
I've always done it just under my purview, my umbrella of the roads and stuff.
So as a board, is there anyone who has an issue with Chris going outside of the whole contract to put salt down?
It sounds like that's part of the job already.
Right. Right. Most of the time, I address it with either John or Vince, say, hey, someone called, I went and looked at this road, we need to do something, and we've applied it.
Can you look at Luann's road based on what she shared tonight?
I can. She's a dirt road. I can't apply salt to dirt road. But there's some other things like the mashed potatoes that occurred last week with the rain and what she's talking about, we can probably get more of that worked off the road and then apply the sand that Wolf can at a heavier amount or something an example.
Okay. I mean, I think it's like, obviously, it's not like giving someone special treatment, but they brought it up and it's a concern. Hear about correct. This, right? Yeah. I think that's great. I mean, it sounds like it's dire in that situation.
Yep.
Is there a criteria that you use, Chris, or just when somebody calls and says, hey, my road's really icy?
To apply the salt, I'll go out and look at it and see what kind of situations are. Most of the time, just the sand is adequate enough. When I've applied it, it's been historically January time, 20 below zero, sand just gets pounded in to the snowpack. Doesn't effectively do anything for us. So I'll come out there, salt cuts it, usually puts it down to the asphalt fairly quickly. And then they're just starting over again. So.
And with that concern about the environment, is that something that the next round of RFPs we wouldn't require from a vendor because of that? Even though everyone else is
the salt?
Oh.
I still think it's a very high concern. You're looking at water systems up in Park City and the surrounding areas whose total dissolved solids, TDS, is rising to a point that will meet the EPA maximums, and they'll have to do something to treat their water because of that. And some of the recent studies have pointed directly to the road salt that's going down.
No, I understand. Yeah, I was reading a lot about this in the last minute of this one. If they're using salt on Bittner Road, that salt is going into our aquifer.
It's going into our lower aquifer, yes.
So what would the difference be between them using salt and us using salt?
So
why are they using it and we're like, oh no, it's really bad, we shouldn't use
it? Well, if I had a choice, I would ask them not to. But our wells are set back and we're looking at the upper roads, and the water's going into the aquifer, flowing down. It all flows downhill. So we're looking at everything kind of close where you have some of these other water systems that have a well fairly close to the highway. So A, even affecting their well, and they don't have any say with UDOT whatsoever. So we're just trying to
extend it too, right? I mean,
correct. Yes.
And they're using it right here in these two roundabouts. Everybody around us is using it. I guess my point is everyone around us is using it except us.
Correct.
And is that a wise?
Well, a lot of what you see also when you're around town, you got curbs and gutter. and all that stormwater is running off and going to I-80 is not. It runs off the side of the road, but they're controlling and mitigating where that water is going. And historically, we've had mainly dirt roads in the neighborhood. Now we're down to mainly the roto-mill roads, or that we could not put salt, like I just said a minute ago, on the dirt road. We can't put it effectively on the roto-mill road because really that's just a...
I'm primarily concerned about it.
Yeah.
So, I saw three people flying on it, including some white. So I'm just not sure. I'm not really vested in the environmental argument because, I've read the article, yes, okay, there's all of us all to totally get it, but everybody's doing it except us. And so I'm not sure that that's...
when we talk about, when we talk about the RFP, if you guys want to add that in, we're more than happy to change that. I just know that where we are set up now and a contractor in the future, they're not going to want to switch back and forth between, hey, I'm going to put sand, and then I'm going to put road salt. And so these roads that we have that can't take the road salt won't get anything.
So
unless we mitigate that at somehow. I'm just saying, like I said, we'll set up to spread sand, the grit, and they're not set up for salt.
Nope. And what you're set up now, in other words, they're just doing sand, and then if we need salt, you go out and do it intermittently or as needed.
Correct. Yeah.
So if we started using salt, in the next RFP, we call for salt. How long would it take for the TDS to show up and do their analyses?
I'd have to ask a hydrologist.
Okay.
I don't know how quick the water percolates into our aquifer.
And then do you think this is an atypical year in terms of how icy? Because I split on Sunday morning also. And what's especially bad is the approach into the roundabout as you're coming down. You guys are there?
Yeah, Carrie brought it up to me last month or whatever.
Is this the county? Or that's
the county is responsible for the roundabouts.
So now the approach into it.
So that approach, I've asked them to sand coming into it, Wolf to sand it coming into that. But the roundabout itself and where we've seen the people run off, you're saying the approach is people go in and try to make that turn. They're either driving up onto the roundabout or they're going over towards the bus stop or vice versa, going over towards Sinclair. Mm-hmm. We can see those tracks. And that's really the county's responsibility.
But if they're not doing it, is it a situation like these other situations where under your role as the road manager, you could augment in that situation if that one spot,
I would say just reach out because the county's not going to have a fit if I'm putting a little material around there.
And then also I guess I could say this, I'll keep it, in the Wolf contract, for example, it has a map of what their territory is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny, unless I read it wrong, it actually doesn't carve out the roundabout from Wolf in that diagram. I know you said that those are the counties, but the diagram...
Well, that's because we put up that RFP not knowing if the county was going to be done with their project.
Okay. Yeah, because I just was curious. I know you said it was the county, but how does Wolf know that they're not supposed to do that if their contract...
So as part of the preseason in the county... took that responsibility. We met with Wolf and described their responsibilities.
So should we, as a whole of community members or board members, continue to see that entry to the roundabout? Or should we let you know and then maybe you could just...
Yeah. Whether it's me or Wolf, something, whatever we need to do there to address that.
And I feel like it's that one spot that's continually, it's almost like you're on a little Disneyland ride. You go into it and it's like, whee! But if you're not ready for it,
Okay, I guess I don't feel that because of my winter tires, but I understand. I've had more than a few people here have discussed it.
And I'm not as worried about me and maybe some of us who are more seasoned drivers, but I do worry about, obviously that doesn't prevent us from it, but I do worry about the teenagers that I have in my house to drive not being as ready to.
We'll just say not as experienced.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
Got to give him a rear-wheel drive car and teach him how to do donuts in the parking lot first.
Well, he is a very fast guy.
They learn how to handle that.
He's a pretty good driver. But.
All right, should we jump into the RFP unless there are any more questions with respect to the condition of the roads?
Wolf? Well, that's good.
Carrie, you want to jump into this?
Yeah, so I'm happy to kind of lay it out. I had just looked at, like, the timing, and I reread the contract, and I know we had talked about this in September that, you know, I think it crept up because I think everyone was busy with the water this summer, and it seemed like the RFP went out and there was just like a two-week window to be able to, you know, get it in quickly because the contract started actually October 1st. So the way I outlined it when I wrote to Scott was, I think it was like around September 9th that the RFP went out. It was September 20-something that the RFP closed. And then we had a contract with Wolves right away because their contract started October 1st. And then when I read their contract, it looks like that it automatically will renew unless we say otherwise prior to July 1st is the language that I found in this contract. And I thought, like, I've heard a couple, you know, I don't know whether it's true or not true, you know, whether Wolf is going to continue to stay in operation. I know it's been a little bit new for them in terms of with their leader having unfortunately passed away. Also, just knowing that we were kind of in a rush to do that RFP and we got a couple, but is there an opportunity to spread our web deeper and wider and to have the RFP open longer? And to make sure not only we're getting the best pricing, but also the best service for you too, because you have to monitor this. Like, this is your headache more than any of ours, right?
Right.
So the thought is, I did the research, and in Utah, an RFP can actually be open 90 days. And so based on the timing, if we need to decide by July 1st, whether or not we want this contract to automatically renew for the next calendar year, my thought was that we proactively posted the RFP for March 1st and did either a 60 or 90 day RFP for next year and tell Wolf that if this is nothing personal, there's a new board, we just want to be, you know, proactive. We want to make sure that we're getting the best rates, all of that. And then if we do that 60 or 90 day time frame, we also will then have time for staff and board to review the results of that RFP and make a decision before July 1st. And if it is that Wolf is the best pricing, your feedback is the season's been great, let's stick with Wolf, then we stick with Wolf. If we determine through that RFP that there may be other options that you even know about through your network, whatever that looks like, it just gives us enough time to be proactive and do great due diligence as a board.
Okay. And Nathan, the July 1st renewal, if we give them notice, let's say at the end of next month, is that all we need to give them, and so that we're not rushing this RFP to go out March 1st? I'm just asking. Is that more than adequate?
I need to look at the contract.
Going forward, okay.
I haven't looked at this one in a while, so I need to look at it to see what sort of notice.
I don't want to miss the date, but I want to make sure that we're getting everything in order since it's February 10th.
Yes, but it's already on the website right now. If you look,
the old one from, but we have to update, make any changes if we want. If we want to put an option in there to see calculations for salt costs, I mean, we can add that right into it and see. I would have to change a little bit of the mapping to make sure that they're not applying salt on dirt roads, that kind of stuff.
I think that's great and reasonable. The contract's pretty simple, Mason, in that it just says that we do have to give them notice.
But it doesn't say when or how.
Before July 1st. The negative of possibly that approach is we would lose this pricing if we cancel it. And then they come back and say, well, you turned us down. Things have gone up. We want a new rate. So I think you bear that risk. So maybe we do an April 1st to give you more time. I think that where you could say 60 days from April 1st, where you have all of April, all of May, and then you could have all of, have the responses due by, like, let's say June 1st, and then you'd have from June 1st till June 30th to evaluate the bids, if that gives you more time. My worry is if you reject this contract, they could come back, and you're kind of locked in a good situation.
I guess my question is, if we're putting out a new RFP, is that canceling the contract?
It's not.
I don't think it is.
Okay.
No.
Okay.
That's
what I need to understand. Okay.
No, because it's there's a specific process we have to follow under the contract.
Well, then we could still do the 90 days, and then I could be presenting in the June board meeting that's whatever that date is.
But you're saying like 90 days may be rushed for you for March 1st. So that's why I was saying if you need till April 1st, you could always do 60 days, but
well,
still a good run for an RFP.
And we don't have to do it right on the 1st. If I have it ready by March 15th, then go out on March 15th.
Yeah.
You're asking so that we have more than a two-week period.
A two-week period, and for you yourself, even just to have a longer window, make more phone calls, spread the web like further and deeper, but then don't jeopardize the current contract, because if the current contract it is what you end up wanting, you haven't canceled it.
Okay.
I mean, it's protective of you.
We have till July 1st
Correct.
For that.
What
yeah.
if we ask them to push to like September 1st? Is there a benefit to doing RFP now versus later?
Well, you don't want to start the contract on October 1st. That's really rushed.
Right,
well,
the RFP
and,
later.
And really, you understand, we started on October 1st, but we really don't have problems.
Yeah.
Sometimes we do, and that's why we started that way. But
yeah, just have it in place.
Yeah, typically we have not had anything in October. And sometimes not even in November. This year has been a very low snow removal bill year.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's good or bad for Wolf, however you look at it. I know there's years that they made very little. But 2 years ago, they made a lot. So.
And maybe it's, I mean, to not ruffle their feathers too. And I mean, I know we're on public record too. I think it would be, probably you have a long relationship with them, to just explain that this isn't personal, right? This is just doing diligence because we just didn't have a lot of time last year. I think the staff was really busy with, you know, the water situation, all of that. So I think it's just making sure that
I agree. And you know, even at our mandatory bid meeting that we held for the RFP, I mean, there was only two qualified vendors in that meeting, even though there was other possible vendors there.
Yeah.
Just because we have those certain criteria that are basically requirements for the service area.
Yeah. So,
and for those that haven't been here for years and years, we have had two different snowplow companies in here over my lifetime in service area.
You've been here a long time now.
Yeah.
Okay.
Any other additions or anything that you'd like to see in the RFP differently?
Don't know. I mean, I think we're probably relying on your subject matter expert.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I feel like if there's other things you want to assess and evaluate, whether it's substand, but I think that I don't know, is the odometer readings, is that difficult to monitor? Is that
we're getting odometer hour readings now on the endless. It's our
rating. I saw that.
Yeah.
Is that something typical you're seeing? Like, is that something that's being monitored in
every? Yes.
Yeah. I mean, if you think there's things that you're not seeing as the road manager that would be helpful to you, or if you want like an SLA, like if you're not getting the I don't know if you're not getting the responses that you need, you could build in there more protection for you as the road manager to make sure that if you call about a concern that you get a response within 24 hours or 12 hours or whatever. I mean,
I'll peruse it with some other people and I'll bounce it just before we submit the RFP.
Yeah.
So the board can look at it.
I think it's helpful to you because you know what's worked and what hasn't worked with Wolf. And so if there's things that haven't worked, this is a great opportunity for you to even what your expectations are as the road manager.
Yeah. Okay.
Chris, I guess with that, I know you, one thing you like about Wolf is having the equipment is being kept here in Silver Creek. Is it a concern for you of having a company, you know, wins the bid out of West Valley
I'm not so much concerned about that as in the equipment being ready and available at any given notice. Like today's weather. The weatherman said we weren't going to have anything. I've got snow up at the top on Folgate right now that is not quite to a plowable level, but we should be out there sanding. Where if there's a company from somewhere distant that isn't monitoring it, may have no clue whatsoever.
So where would the equipment be staged if it's not full?
Whoever the contractor is, we have always made available the well house for them to stage that equipment.
So there is.
I think the one of the contractors that submitted a proposal this year, they wanted to mow equipment on and off. But like these durations where we're not doing snow removal, they would take the equipment away, but they wanted to charge additional mobilization fees. And I said that wasn't going to fly. So it is very nice that the equipment's owned and positioned here within the neighborhood.
Could we also get a little more transparency on the startup fee? What that's for?
Well, we discussed that when we weren't here.
Okay. I can get you offline and we can talk a little bit more about it. So.
And I think like in the RFP, like that was one thing. It wasn't in the RFP. And I know like in some contract situations, like there are startup costs or whatever. But maybe if you know what's typical, maybe when they're responding, maybe the RFP can outline what you're willing to pay for the startup costs. You know, what are you seeing some account, like other areas, or what you feel like, did you feel that was reasonable? Did you feel like that was too high? Do you feel like that was good? Do you want to outline in the RFP what the startup costs would be? Or, I mean, you know how much these, I don't know how much the edgers and the chains and those things cost, and I won't even try and Google that.
No, I'll see if we can get more detail on that.
So. And then it's like, you don't come back and someone brings you their contract after the RFP and it's like, we want $50,000 in startup costs. You know, like, so maybe that's part of your, what you're outlining is what we're willing to do with the startup cost.
So.
Okay. Good on roads. Anyone else have any
questions? I guess if I can just get some clarification on moving forward with the RFP, I guess direction is you'd like the staff to have an RFP out no later than April 1st or so?
Yeah, and if we can do it a little before, we will. We'll keep you apprised for that.
And I think that if you go with April 1st or if you do anything really past March 1st, I think maybe you should do a 60-day RFP, not a 90-day. Just in the 90-day,
in the public. I forget the name of it, where we submit this. Yeah. There's the public notice place where we'll put it.
But there's the
Utah Purchasing Department will submit it as well, where all the bids can go to. It's any day. Like I showed you last year, Salt Lake County's bid went out after ours, and it was only open for 2 weeks. The goal here is what I'm getting is we just want max amount of time so we can hopefully get more potential vendors.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think you just have to be careful not to go over that maximum according to the code and the law, you know, which is that 90-day window, but I don't think we're going to do that.
No. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for doing the heavy lifting.
Sure.
Great. Next item is public comments part two. So we have members of the public here and online. We'll open it up to those who are present here. If anyone would like to speak, we ask you to state your name and address or parcel. Mm-hmm. No. Jody, we have anyone online that would like to speak?
I am double checking right now. Most are two onliners have already spoken, so we're good here.
Okay. Hearing no public comments, I'd direct it to Rick if you would like to move us into closed session.
Hi, Rick Parisi. Motion that we move out of our public meeting and move into a closed session to discuss the character, professional competence, or physical or mental health of an individual,
pending or reasonably imminent litigation and or the sale or purchase of real property pursuant to Utah Code 52-4-204 through 205. Does someone second this motion?
I second it.
Aye.
The vote is unanimous at 7:15 p.m. The service area 3 is moving out of public meeting.
Who seconded that motion, please?
That was Scott. Rick made the motion, Scott seconded.